In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking with Randall Jelks. He's an historian. He teaches at Calvin College, which is in Grand Rapids, Michigan. He grew up in Chicago. His particular area of interest is African-American history and the African-American church. He's here visiting the campus to talk about some of the things that interest him, and was good enough to come stop by here and talk with us a little bit. We said that we'd be talking about race in American politics, and we'd be doing that. Perhaps we'll get into some other areas as well. And certainly as we talk, your questions are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. At any point here, you're welcome to call, ask a question, make a comment. We ask only that people just try to be brief so that we can keep things moving along and get in as many folks as possible. But anyone is welcome into the conversation. Again, 333-WILL. Toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you.
As I started thinking about the conversation that we'd have, and we sort of put this title on, we said race in American politics. So I started going out there and looking for race in this year's election. And I guess it seemed to me not all that easy to find. Now, maybe that's just reflects my outlook. There has been discussion on the presidential level and elsewhere of issues like racial profiling and hate crime legislation.
Sure. Yes.
But as I, you know, cast my eyes around and look at things where race is a definite angle, it doesn't seem to be playing a big role in this election. Do you think that it is?
Oh, I think it's the subtext of the election. I think the issues about the death penalty is a subtext of this issue. I think both presidential candidates are Southerners now. George W. Bush grew up in Texas, so I consider him a Southern politician, even though his family's roots are in New England and Connecticut in particular. So the subtext of this is partly about race. George W. Tried to display a new face on the Republican Party that had to do with immigrants and blacks and other people being representative. Even though it was theater, it was important theater in the sense that it's going to force the Republican Party, whether it likes it or not, to change its old strategy, Southern strategy from the South, that is, that the Republican Party made a pact with the devil, I like to say, beginning in the 1950s when the Dixiecrats, the Strom Thurmonds of the world, left the Democratic Party, switched to the Republican Party, and the Republican Party booted its black members out now and whitenized the party. That began, of course, much early in the 20s with Herbert Hoover, but it found voice in the post-World War II years. The Republican, Richard Nixon, Ronald Reagan used that strategy. So that race is a subtext of this election. It is a subtext of this election around the appointment of justices to the Supreme Court. Race and, of course, the issues of abortion around those issues of women's right to choose. All of those are subtexts that are not being spoken by. And because they're not being spoken by and articulated, to me, they could rise all the more to the forefront. The problem for both of these gentlemen, they're both from the South. They have Southern American history to live down or live with, and both of them know that, but they don't want to offend the American people and sensibilities. I give President Clinton credit for daring to broach at least a conversation about it. I don't think it was a successful conversation, but I want to give him credit for daring to broach a conversation about it.
Yeah, I think that historically, African Americans have been considered to be more likely to vote Democrat than vote Republican. That might lead the parties to, on might lead Republicans on the one hand to say, well, there's no point in us trying to appeal to African Americans, and Democrats on the other hand to say, well, these folks are in our camp so that we don't have to do anything special. Is that – has that gone on?
Well, the Republican Party pushed black voters out of the Republican Party up until the Kennedy-Nixon issue. The Kennedy-Nixon election, black Americans were part of the Republican Party, a small percentage, 15%. With 1964, with the Goldwater attempt to run against the Civil Rights Bill and run against the conclusions of black Americans, the Republican Party pushed black Americans out intentionally so they could win white Southerners. In fact, in the South, the blacks are the Democrats and the whites are the Republicans. So that's that issue, it seems to me, is one of the subtexts of this campaign. The Republicans can no longer run that old Southern strategy anymore. That's played out as America becomes more and more multicultural, with new immigrants coming from Asia and Africa and the Caribbean into the United States.
Hmm. Well, what sort of role do you see black voters playing in this election?
Well, I think black voters in large urban areas will play if they come out to vote. And that's will most likely vote for the Democratic candidate, Albert Gore. If they come out to vote in great numbers, it will bode well for Gore because he will win, particularly in the South. That is, black voters are the swing voters in the South. You know, in states like Georgia, Tennessee, Mississippi, black voters make up roughly 30% of the population. So Al Gore needs these people to come out and vote in order for him to win. And there'll be a swing voters in those large cities from Los Angeles to San Francisco and on, and Chicago particularly. And he's got to get that base out to vote.
Mm-hmm. And just in thinking about some of the things that we might talk about, I just spent a little time yesterday on the web taking a look at some black newspapers around the country. Just interested in what sort of things were being discussed specifically when it came to the election. And it seemed to me that was indeed the one thing that was prominently being discussed, the issue of the fact that it's important for people to register and then it's important for people to vote, the turnout sort of question.
Sure.
And is that something that's uncertain, that is, one can't really say whether indeed black people are going to vote?
Black Americans are like all Americans. These candidates have not articulated a larger vision for anyone to want to come out and vote for them. Mm-hmm. One of my colleagues here at the University of Illinois described it as, you have the insufficient and the insufferable. And that's how these two candidates are playing you, so it makes it very difficult. I think black Americans will come out to vote in their interests. Their interests are not all alike. I don't want to say African Americans are a monolith by any stretch of the imagination, but they will come out to vote their public policy interests.
I thought it interesting that just, I think it was just yesterday, Jesse Jackson made a statement endorsing Al Gore, mm-hmm. Saying something to the effect that we know that one or the other of these men will be the next president. It's either going to be Al Gore or George Bush. And I think the quote, as I recall, it was something like African Americans should make the mature political choice, and knowing that it's going to be one or the other, vote for the person that would be the best choice for them. And in his mind, that's Al Gore. And I don't know if he was specifically trying to get at the issue that perhaps African Americans, if they were going to choose another alternative, might be likely to think about voting for Ralph Nader or somebody else. Well, that seemed to reflect an interesting sort of political pragmatism on his part.
Sure. Al Gore has excluded the people who are his base. He's not been a very, in my estimation, smart politician. One of the things that we'll see how if he'll win or not. He didn't get Jesse Jackson out campaigning for him earlier. He should have, so that reflects Jesse Jackson's own coolness toward Gore. Let me say my own personal opinion. The election of George Bush would not bode well public policy wise for me as an African American. I think he will include certain people into his cabinet, and I'm glad to see that. Colin Powell and Condoleezza Rice are great, great individuals. But public policy-wise, the Republican Party has not demonstrated any commitment to urban renewal, progressive urban policies to deal with the core of our cities. His education program, on reading alone, hasn't proved to turn around the old Jim Crow system of Texas in terms of education, nor has he tackled it. So I don't think that it will bode well public policy-wise for African-Americans, those African-Americans who are locked in the working classes and the lower classes in the cities of our great urban areas.
Mm-hmm. You talked about the fact that you felt that race was, and issues of race was an important subtext, mm-hmm. something that's not being discussed but is certainly a part of the issues that are being discussed.
Yes.
How does one, or how do individuals who would like to see these issues discussed in a more open way, elevate them above the level of subtext?
Sure. The issue of race in America, first of all, are important for all Americans. I sometimes think we talk about these issues as they're the strictly the province of African Americans or the Hispanics or whoever is the minority person being discriminated. But the problem of race is a historical problem in our culture, and it belongs to everybody, and we need to talk about it in a mature fashion and to discuss and dialogue about these important problems. Race is used as a subtext for class often. Race is a kind of defining feature. When I walk down the street, if I don't have a suit and tie on and if I'm just wearing a baseball cap to my office, normally where I teach and a number of faculty members will tell you campus security will stop you. So it's an important thing for discussion. Parents visiting campus mistake an African-American professor for one of the custodial staff. These are still little remnants, but certainly things are not like it was 40 years ago before the civil rights bills of the 60s were passed. But they're the important issues for us to discuss as a society. And it says on how we are going to ask all of our people to participate civically and feel that they are included and equal participants.
Yeah. It reminds me just of a conversation that one of my colleagues here had with another guest yesterday, who mm-hmm. happened to be an Asian American woman mm-hmm. who is a journalist mm-hmm. who has written a book about Asian Americans and
sure.
their experiences. And to make sure that people understand it, when we talk about race in this country, what we seem to end up talking about is relationships between black people and white people,
sure.
but it's certainly not just that kind of
no.
issue. And the thing that I moved to think about is, and I'm sure other Asian Americans say the same thing, is that sometimes when people meet them who really don't know them, she says that people will say to her, where are you from? She was born in the United States and she grew up here. And she says, well, I'm from New Jersey. and then people will say, no, they won't get that. And they'll say, no, really, no. Where are you from? Somehow that there are some people
sure.
who just can't quite get
sure.
the idea that this Asian woman could be from New Jersey. And it seems like, as as this country becomes more diverse, this kind of challenge of sort of dealing with it and understanding right. and living with it is only going to become more complicated.
Yeah, I want to say something. I think that the reason we fall to black and white is that we still have, as a country, not acknowledged that we were the largest slaveholding society in the world. By the end of the Civil War, 4 million people were freed from slavery. That's quite remarkable. And until we can deal with that question, this issue lies at the heart of it. I was talking to Dr. Vernon Burton's Southern History class yesterday, and I said to them that, we have to face this issue. We were a slave-holding society. Until we acknowledge that and say how that distorted our social system, we won't get at all the other complications. And that's not to say it's an important acknowledgement. Racism and racist understandings fall all over the place, but we certainly need to get at the original set of immigrants that came into the country, and those were Europeans from England and Germany and so forth, and Africans. If you look at the earliest census of the U.S., African population is a part of the high percentage of what formed these United States, even though they weren't counted in that census, as we know, for historical and political reasons. But until we deal with that, we're not going to get at any other important things that are going on about our new multicultural society, because even new immigrants feel the effect of this long history of racism in the country. I mean, Amadou Diallo certainly had nothing to do with American slavery or anything like that, but he had black skin and was mistaken as a black American. And, of course, we know what happened in New York City. And so these issues have to be dealt with, and we have to face them head on.
I should probably reintroduce our guest for anyone who's tuned in the last little bit here. We're speaking with Randall Jelks. He's an historian. He teaches history at Calvin College, which is in Grand Rapids, Michigan. He's particularly interested in African-American history. He's here visiting the campus and spending a little time with us talking about race in America and race in American politics. And certainly your questions and comments are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I think just in response to the last sort of comments you make, that a lot of people, a lot of Americans, people of goodwill, in hearing what you say about the fact that we as a nation have to somehow come to grips with the fact that we were a slaveholding nation and a significant number of people, black people, were brought here against their will, and that they had an important role to play in the economy of this country at that time and so forth. I think that a lot of people would simply say, I don't know what to do with that. Mm-hmm. I have that knowledge. I hear what you're saying. Mm-hmm. But they would say, so now, 100 years, more than 100 years after, what do we do with that?
Well, of course, it's not more than 100 years after. 1965, the Voting Rights Act came in. That's only now, 35 years. Mm-hmm. But what we do with that knowledge is that we commit ourselves to working on issues of justice and equality. I had a conversation. I've been talking about racial reconciliation with Christian faculty members this morning. And then what I said to them this morning, that the great problems around our nations are faced here in Champaign, Illinois. Wouldn't it be remarkable if the university said, well, we're in this endowment campaign of $1.5 billion. Wouldn't it be remarkable that the university said, we're going to make a commitment, part of that money is to deal with the inequities of the educational system here in Champaign and deal with that and face that right on. That would go a long way toward building racial reconciliation, because as long as we have school systems of haves and have-nots, we reinforce the class structure as it exists, and we isolate people. So my thought is that, and what what's so tragic is the timidity, being so timid about engaging those great issues with all of this mind power that you have right here in Champaign. If you can't do it in Champaign, you know certainly you can't do it in Chicago or New York. To make a stance and be a model of engagement. I don't see professors even going over and teaching physics in some of the Champaign high schools. And yet all the university professors complain about these minority students are ill-prepared and blah, 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 and why aren't they prepared better? It seems to me that my grandmother would say that's process alfalfa. It's cow manure. The university then is this it's not about a mission of education, but it is about a mission of corporatization, and so that just sort of reifies our current structure.
We have a couple of callers here to talk with. We have somebody from a car phone, so we'll get to them first here on line number two. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to make sort of a comment combined with a question. One of the issues that seems to me to be a really difficult issue to get over just occurred when you made the comment, we are such a racist nation. And I sit here, and I'm only second generation, and I say, I'm not a racist. I'm just trying to live. It's hard enough just to survive for myself. Why do I have the responsibility to make up the ills that were done to another group of people when I wasn't even in the country and my relatives weren't in the country yet? And I'm not at all racist, but I get that immediate reaction as soon as someone says, we are. Okay. You know, and I think that's what gets a lot of people very upset is, then we're told, well, basically, you have the advantage of being a white person in this society, so you are advantaged. Mm-hmm. And I look at it, and I don't feel advantaged.
Oh, I agree with you to an extent. There is no brass ring for any of us out there. We're all struggling. However, when you buy a house sometimes, when you buy your house, you sometimes get a leaky roof, and you got to fix it. When you become an American citizen, if your family immigrated, then they also bought into the kind of structural faults that were part of this country. Let me just finish here. And we all, when I say we, I mean we all have to remedy the kind of structural fault that our roof is leaking and has certain problems, and we have to acknowledge, from my perspective, that structure benefited certain people.
I agree with you totally. What I'm saying is I think part of the problem we have in getting people to accept that responsibility is that they get very defensive when they're basically being used in the word we, that we need to have more sensitivity and not say we and just say the society you live in has a history.
Right.
And maybe to say if we can improve the house, if we can fix the leak, you'll be much better. You won't get rained on.
Well, when I use the word we, I'm talking about all of us. That is, every American citizen falls prey to this, and I use the word we intentionally. I don't exclude myself. I'm an African American. I don't exclude myself from that. We have to deal with this together with Asian Americans, all Americans of every stripe and hue, to talk about this. Now, one of the points you make is very interesting. One of the things that we have not done in the society is build a level of trust to talk about our concerns and our issues without full-scale judging of anybody's humanity about raising questions or differences of opinion. And that troubles me, and that troubles me on university campus after university campus that I visit, that we have not learned to model even a dialogue on important issues. I see universities as communities of discourse, Faculty can't discourse, and so our students don't know how to discourse about these really important issues. But I do think it is a we, and I don't want to separate Americans out in that way. Now, I use we as I'm a part of the solution and or part of the problem as all of my fellow Americans.
Right. I agree with you. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call. Let's go to Champaign, and this is line number one. Hello.
Hi. I have some questions that will take us in a slightly different direction.
Sure.
But I'm interested in your discussing the development of anti-Semitism within the black community and black-Jewish relationships,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and the various ways that you see that is developing, and the, how should I say, potential for healing in that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, that's a very important question. First of all, let me say that African American elite and Jewish elite were allies in the civil rights struggle.
Yes.
And that's an important history we should not forget. Jewish Americans were discriminated against and in the United States, surely as black Americans, excluded from the great institutions of learning in this country, systems of quotas, and all of that. And so that is a wonderful, rich history. However, there is another side of that history that is not so rich and not as positive in terms of the working classes of black people, Jewish, some Jewish people were salespeople and store owners and owners of properties in their communities, which some ordinary people was made for class resentment and hostilities. Certainly, Jews were in a much better position to reap the rewards when the society opened up than black people were. Use this line, moved up like the Jeffersons and so forth, grand tradition of education and so forth, allowed them to have mobility in a way that black Americans did not have mobility. So there are tensions that sometimes anti-Semitisms, when you look at the language that is used, and it is anti-Semitic language, is also based in class resentment and resentment of a group that seemingly have moved up, and we have to deal with that issues. There are also international issues that are now interfering with black Jewish relationships. The question of Palestinians, black Americans have tended to be somewhat sympathetic to the Palestinian cause. Not all black Americans. Many black American Christians are unconsciously, are Zionists because they think that the Bible, Jews are God's people in the sense of God's special people. Then there's a tension in the community about, on one hand, Jews have been a role model from slavery on, the Exodus story. On the other hand, there is a sense of unfairness in the kind of negotiation about the Palestinian people there. So those are problems. A wonderful question that you asked, and again, kinds of questions that we have to talk about. There are troublesome things. I find it troublesome that someone like Louis Farrakhan can use anti-Semitic language and yet wish to have respect for his own ethnic community. So I think that we have to, again, be open and talk about that and correct people and understand when we differ and disagree about things.
Okay. If I could just bring up, it seems that sometimes the issue is exacerbated by, how should I say, the urban tensions of of two communities interacting, and often it's, should I say, the the communities who are fighting over crumbs, whereas the powers that be are in neither of those communities,
sure.
and yet are redirected
sure.
into the conflict between those communities.
Well, you know, crabs in a barrel, we got to fight. I mean, that's what you're absolutely right about that. But it seems to me that it was always, when change has come in America, it has always been a critical minority of people who have had goodwill. And we need to come together around those critical minorities about issues that bring us together.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you for your question.
We're talking this morning here in this Barn Focus 580 with Randall Jelks. He's an historian. He teaches at Calvin College, which is in Grand Rapids, Michigan. He's particularly interested in African-American history and also the African-American church. He's here visiting the campus and is spending some time with us. We're talking about race in America and race in politics. That's where we started the conversation. And questions, comments are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Next caller up is Freeport. It's line number 4. Hello?
Yeah, good morning.
Good morning.
Speaking about race here, what's your comment on Elijah Muhammad, the leader of the black Muslims, made a very prominent statement and was quite publicized in the black Muslim literature after that, too. He made this prominent statement that the white race, all whites were devils. That's about as racist as you can get, I'd say.
Oh, I think it's that comment is certainly chauvinistic. The only thing I can say about that comment is that I disagreed. Of course, that in the defense of Mr. Muhammad, at the time that he was making those statements, the dominant culture was certainly as chauvinistic as his comment was. But, you know, if you're asking me if I agree with the comment, no, I don't agree with the comment at all. I think that is a chauvinistic comment, as I would disagree that are those people who said in the 1950s that black people were cursed by God. So I don't agree with that.
Yes?
Yes.
Well, it certainly increased tension between the black and white races in this country, what he did.
Well, I don't know about that, but, you know, I think white people were, what Elijah Muhammad did was for the first time allow white people to hear the deep resentment that black people had about the power that was lauded over them. One would have not had known anything about Elijah Muhammad except for the advent of Malcolm X. And Malcolm X sort of, as the charismatic spokesman for the Nation of Islam, allowed us into the world of Elijah Muhammad. Elijah Muhammad wanted to go about his work very quietly and without fanfare. And then came the media star, Malcolm X, and we learned about the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. You know, to be fair to all of our parties, you asked me about my personal opinion. I disagree with that. I would think bigotry is bigotry, no matter what stripe it is.
I believe, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, that among the many ways that Malcolm X departed from the thinking of the Nation of Islam was this very point. He challenged the power structure of the Nation of Islam, and he was killed for it. Does that within the Nation of Islam, do they still use language like that today?
Let me be fair to my Muslim brothers and sisters. Is the American Muslim Mission, which is run by Imam Wadin Muhammad, who is Elijah Muhammad's son, who is an Orthodox Muslim who sees his special mission as an Islamic minister to black Americans who profess Orthodox Islam. There is the other camp run by Minister Farrakhan, who is still in the tradition. But even Minister Farrakhan is trying to find language and ways to move from the old language of the Founding Father.
Again, we continue here. There's a caller in Urbana. Line number 1.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I wanted to say a couple things. I teach at Eastern Illinois, and I just showed my class a film. It's called Sa-I-Gu. It's S-A-I-G-U. It's a Korean women's view of the L.A. riots.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I'd like to see it.
Oh, it's a wonderful film. Yeah. I really recommend it. I have a copy, but it was...
Will you give me that title again, please?
Yeah, it's S-A, and this is all in caps, S-A-I-G-U, Sa-I-Gu, which literally translates as April 29th, which was the day of the Rodney King verdict.
Okay, that's S-A-I-G-U?
Right.
Okay.
It's a very powerful film. Okay. I show it in a course. I do a little unit on intercultural communication.
Uh-huh.
I show it in there. It's tremendously powerful. I have a few African-American students typically, and mostly European-American students,
sure.
Occasionally and a Hispanic-American student.
Mm-hmm.
And it allows me to talk about exactly what you're talking about. I really appreciate your comments. And hopefully to get to some of the feelings. And it's very dramatic in that hour, and I'm using hour to talk about European-American European-Americans and the African-American students and whoever I have.
Mm-hmm.
Typically, they weren't in L.A. They didn't know about this.
Sure.
And so their view of that uprising, whatever you want to call that, is very much media-based. It is entirely mainstream media-based. And so this is a very different view, and they are just outraged that they didn't know anything about it. They are... and so it does give us a chance to talk about race in America. It gives us a chance to talk about their feelings about that,
mm-hmm.
which is difficult,
mm-hmm.
And I work real hard at that, but it is very difficult. They have feelings about it, but they're reluctant to express those feelings because they're afraid that they will be seen as racist, that they will be seen in a way that is not, I would argue, in a way that is not consistent with how they feel, but they just don't know what to do with all of that.
Sure. And you are doing exactly what I think many of us ought to be doing, creating a forum for people to talk. I mean, African-Americans have just as many feelings as their Asian or European counterparts about things going on in the United States that are as complex.
And they
need a forum as well for talking about conflictual feelings about certain things. What is class? What is race? What is bad behavior? So forth. So we all need a forum for talking about these things.
I agree, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
It's real important that we do what we can to try to step into another cultural community's perspective.
That's correct.
It's hard to do.
That's right.
But that's one of the things that the film kind of makes impossible not to do,
right.
At least to some degree.
And you, speaking of that L.A. riot, I call it a riot because it sort of exuberance took over.
Mm-hmm.
But it was the most multicultural uprising or riot that I ever saw. In fact, it got so exuberant, I saw a man with a yarmulke throwing a rock and getting a television on the camera. I don't think they meant to do that, but there were all kinds of stripes of people and in that community. And, you know, the people in that community now, we can see this over and over now that the L.A. police is being federally investigated,
mm-hmm.
this problem, disconnect between law enforcement and the communities they were supposed to serve were real problems.
Oh, absolutely. And I talk about that
mm-hmm.
in the institutional
sure.
racism in
sure.
the L.A. I was born and raised in California,
yeah.
so I know a little bit about
right. sure.
All of that. And it's a dynamite film. It's real useful to get students talking about that. And
I think that's real important. I thank you for sharing that. And who's that? Who puts this film out?
It's two Korean women, Korean-American women, I believe, who produced it,
mm-hmm.
and they have footage of the riot,
yeah.
and they interviewed a number of women who lost their businesses
sure.
in
sure.
them, and so it's from that perspective. It's a documentary, so it was on probably PBS, and
yeah. Well, I'll do a search find it, but you know, keep what you're doing up. I mean, it's important that we begin to talk about our conflictual feelings and work at it.
Thank you. I was wondering if you could comment just a bit on how the media handles race issues. Again,
oh, very poorly, of course.
I guess they have a hard
Well, you know, let me say this, I want to say about the O.J. case, because that's another California case in the media. This is a case, a very simple case. It was about a man being jealous and killing his wife. And that happens over and over in America. And that's a tragedy. And it's an outrage of domestic abuse, men killing their spouses. But this one got all of the Hollywood glamour, and then it took on the kind of racial politics after the kind of L.A. riot and so forth, and the frustrations in South Central L.A. Rather than this case becoming a case simply about a rich man who had a lot of money who could hire good lawyers, mm-hmm. it became about America's racial politics, and all Americans got sucked into it, both blacks and whites. Blacks defending O.J. and whites seeing this as the most important issue there was out there. It got that way because in back of our minds there are images about black sexuality and black bodies and white bodies and all of this confusing nonsense. Rather than this being handled as typical, and that rich people can hire good lawyers. Mm-hmm. The travesty is poor people can't hire good lawyers to get off their crimes. And so the media sort of exacerbates rather than explains, helpful and help us clarify what is going on in these issues. And the tragedy is because so many of the people behind the production cameras are not asking the right questions, in my opinion.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Right, thanks for the call. We have about 5 minutes left. One thing that I am interested in having you talk about is the steadily growing, at this point I think it's maybe not as big an issue as it might be, conversation about reparations
mm-hmm.
for slavery.
Yes. Yeah.
Something that people certainly have been talking about in the past. I think it got a big boost after the publication mm-hmm. of the book The Debt, which was written by
Randall
Robinson,
yes.
A guy who's been a political activist for a long time,
right.
Was involved in the civil rights
right.
movement, and it came out just right around the beginning of the year.
Yeah.
And that helped, I think, put this issue on a more national level,
sure.
And I think we're going to be hearing more about it, and I believe, in fact, even there are some people who are looking at the issue of the possibility of actually launching a class action lawsuit,
mm-hmm.
and I'm not sure who they would be suing,
mm-hmm.
but as I said, I think this is going to be something that, as a nation, we're going to be talking
sure.
more and more about.
Well, we have already talked about it. I think Japanese Americans receive small reparations for having their properties taken during the Second World War. Jews from Europe are, Jewish communities seeking reparations, rightly so, for the kind of stolen property in the Holocaust. No one wanted to deal with the kind of real deprivations that Black Americans have. I don't know how we carry out any forms of reparations, but it is a conversation. It is an important one for us to. Again, I say us to talk about, to give attention to Randall's book, that we might read it closely, hear it, and then make comments rather than willy-nilly making comments before we've engaged in reading what he has to say and why. And then have a conversation about it. I'm not sure where I stand on the issue, and I'm not sure. When do we stop reaching back? But at least I want to say that Randall's put that book out. It's an important one, and it's an important issue for us to discuss. And by discussing it, it is also acknowledging that our history has been fraught with this slavery Indian removal, all of those things. Some people benefited by that, and others were excluded. So we have to talk about it.
Yeah. I think probably Japanese Americans, just to take one example of looking at what happened there, would say that the payments that they received were was not really the point.
No,
the point was the principle of the matter.
That's
and
correct.
The fact that. It was acknowledged.
That's correct.
That what happened was wrong.
Right. Oh, you know, one of the things I do Southern history and as an African American historian, and being in Charleston, South Carolina, one of the disconnects is that Charleston was the port of entry for almost 30 to 40% of American slaves. That's where our Statue of Liberty should be. And there is no acknowledgement in the city of Charleston, although there is an attempt for a museum, that this was a place where slaves came in and helped make this country rich through the growing of rice and indigo and other things like that. And until those kinds of things are done, we feel old. In the city of Chicago, Jean-Baptiste DuSable was the founder of Chicago, Dominican coming in of African descent. There is no statue of DuSable. There is one school located on the south side, but there is no statue of DuSable that says to Chicagoans, you know, this fur trader of African descent was the founder of this city and so forth.
Well, we're at the point where we're going to have to stop. My apologies. I have a caller here we simply can't take. But I'm sure in other ways, other days, other people will be discussing some of the same issues. For the moment, we want to say to our guest, Randall Jelks. He's professor of history at Calvin College, Grand Rapids. Thank you.
Thank you.